natural goodness, one of a kind. My favorite herb of any I know, and healing me like never before. And she is my cup of tea.
Good evening, everyone. You're listening to WMFO Medford. This is Izzy Borshoff with another episode of In Your 20s. For those of you who haven't listened before, In Your 20s is a show where I talk to people about navigating the challenging decade of early adulthood. And today on the show, we're lucky to have Kevin Frazier to talk about decision-making in your 20s and with a bit of a professional focus. So, Kevin, how does it feel to be competing with the Bachelor finale for an audience tonight?
Oh, geez. Well, I don't know if I'm going to be walking home with a rose tonight, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, I don't know if we can create that same atmosphere for you in the studio here, but I'm sure we'll have a bit of fun tonight.
We'll find a way. Plenty of drama, just all the intrigue.
Exactly. So, on that subject, your LinkedIn, it's an impressive list of job titles for someone who's, how old are you, 25?
25, you nailed it.
25. So how many jobs do you think you've had in your 20s?
Oof. Depends what you define as a job. And I'd say jobs, about four.
It's pretty solid.
It's a fair amount, yeah.
What's a job?
I guess we could say job would be, you get a W-2 at the end of the year for your taxes.
Which to me means
which to
very
means,
little,
yeah.
But I'm going to assume it's something to do with having money taken away from you.
Yeah, it's your tax form. So when the Trump administration wants to take your money, what you have to give to them. But it also is just the formal process of actually signing up with a company, or I guess if you started your own company, you would have to fill out something similar.
Right. Okay. And maybe you can just walk us through what those four jobs have been.
Yeah. So right out of school, I had a really awesome opportunity. I had just graduated from the University of Oregon, was riding high on the fact that I had gotten into UC Berkeley School of Law and thought, this is it. I'm going to law school 3 years and then I'm out and we'll see what the world happens. And then, oddly enough, I got a call on Christmas Eve from a random number and I was about to let it go to voicemail, but I thought, oh, what the hell? I'll just pick it up. Sure enough, it was an offer to go be Governor Kate Brown's executive assistant in Oregon. And I thought, ooh, this is enticing. For those who don't know, Governor Brown is a great progressive leader in Oregon who's done incredible things in a few brief years as governor. Most recently, she's trying to get rid of having to pay for stamps to mail in your ballot. So, good role
wow,
model
yeah.
to have. Yeah. And so I kind of looked at myself in the mirror and thought, what is it that I really want to do in law school? And I couldn't answer that as well as I wanted to. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to give this a shot and ask for a deferral from Berkeley to go be Governor Brown's body person. And sure enough, it worked out. And so then there was this year of following her around the state, doing all sorts of shenanigans from writing speeches to making sure I had Clif Bars ready to go.
Does she have a favorite flavor?
Oof.
Or did you like to mix things up?
I'm not sure I can disclose that.
Oh, right,
that.
Okay, yeah.
Ooh, you know,
probably need some kind of
the
clearance.
The Dignitary Protection Unit might take me out. But yeah, so learned tons, and it was really humbling to see what it's like to have to be in that sort of tough environment as an executive. And so it really proved invaluable instead of just going straight through to law school. And now I think that we're both in the same shoes of being graduate students and identifying those people who go straight through. I'm kind of glad I wasn't that guy who just only knew school. Well, sure enough, eventually I started asking, what else can I do? Can I do this? Can I do that? What more can I take on? And eventually, with every job, I think you kind of hit that point of perhaps doing quite enough activity or quite enough questioning that it gets to a point of, is this the right job for me at that point? And I had asked that question enough times that I went to go be an economic consultant with a firm called Echo Northwest and traded my Clif Bars for the trail mix available at the office.
Can I just stop you there?
Yeah.
on that point? Because I think this is something that a lot of people in their early 20s grapple with is knowing when it's time to say, all right, let's move on to the next job. Like, do you have kind of markers that help you make that decision, or do you find that you just have an instinctive feel for it?
It is a really tough one. And I think coming from a family where my dad worked for AT&T for 30 long years.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is just crazy to consider, because you don't hear about anyone working for a company for 30 years, let alone 3 years in some cases mm-hmm. these days. And so that was a really, really tough moment to decide to leave the governor's office. And I think what you have to do is kind of have this figurative North Star that you're always pursuing. And for me, that's always been, do I feel as though I'm adding as much value as I can to the organization? And to some extent, am I replaceable? And I got to a point with the governor where I did feel like I'd perhaps grown as much as I could in that job. And the more questions I asked, it wasn't a matter of answering those questions in my current form or in my current position. It was a question of, well, you're going to have to go get some more experience or go see things from a different angle. And that was tough to hear. And it was something that I had to kind of wrestle with. But eventually I thought, what else can I do to learn new skills, to add value somewhere else, and perhaps get a better sense of how I can move closer to that North Star, whatever it may be at that point in time, because it tends to shift.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And do you find that that's a decision you come to largely on your own, or do you have mentors or family members or people that you routinely go to kind of test those ideas?
Yeah, I'd say you should always be reaching out to people, because their 2 cents are probably worth a nickel in comparison to whatever judgment you think you're going to come to alone. And so I am very quick to pick up the phone, ask for a coffee, not only because I'm addicted to caffeine and hot chocolate, but also because people who have been in different work environments, they can help you assess what kind of work environment might be best for you. So I think, especially in your 20s, it's so important to suss out what is it that you don't want to do. And that's often not the perspective that people think about in their 20s. It's so much of, I've got to find the perfect job, and I want to be able to write all my high school classmates that I'm kicking ass, and I'm going to be the rock star at the reunion who started the next Facebook or whatever. And really, you don't need to do that. You don't need to find that perfect job because it's unlikely you're going to, A. So it's a lot more freeing when instead you're asking, what do I like about this job? What do I don't?
What do I dislike?
Whoa, as you know, it's past my bedtime, so, excuse me.
We're very lucky to have Kevin here past 9 p.m.
another thing of the early 20s, I guess, is you'll learn your own sleep schedule very quickly. But so I have always been asking people for guidance on what attributes in a job I should be looking for to determine if it's a good fit or not. And with each job I've had, I've learned something that I don't want to be doing that's helping me get closer and closer to feeling that ultimate sense of fulfillment.
Right. And I think you're so right. We're never told to pursue jobs with a view to finding out what we don't want to do. But I think that can be so valuable just when in an age when we're kind of overwhelmed by choice, or at least, you know, people with a certain level of privilege who have a good education are overwhelmed by choice. And so narrowing down can be difficult. And that's like a valuable way of doing it if you can do it early on.
And that's a super important thing to point out is I have been so, so fortunate to have folks willing to support me and provide that comfort when I'm taking on big risks, both financially and emotionally, that isn't available to everyone. And so some of my advice may not be entirely applicable to folks, but I really do think from an economic standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, and from a community standpoint, if we found better ways to give people choices about their career, it would work out for everyone, right? Because at least in my case, you feel most compelled to do good work when you actually want to show up, right? And especially in your 20s, if you're showing up to a job where you're leaving unhappy or you're having to drag yourself there in the morning, it's probably a good sign you're not at the right place. And as soon as you get that sense of I'm really not learning, I think it's important to first engage your employer and say, hey, what opportunities, what side projects, what whatever might exist that I could be exploring here. And if you try and you try and you try and there's just no other avenue to pursue, that's really when you should start looking elsewhere.
So I have another question on that. I think it's kind of related to what we've been talking about. Something that I think I've certainly struggled with and a lot of my friends have struggled with is finding yourself in the workforce for the first time and wondering whether you actually deserve more responsibility than you're getting, or whether our generation has just been brought up with a really unrealistic expectation of what working is like and what we're going to be empowered to achieve. And then in reality, everyone's got to do an entry-level job at some point in their life. So how do you differentiate between a job that's kind of less than what you deserve rather than a job that is actually just going to be a bit of a launch pad, even if it feels boring now?
It's a great question and a really, really tough one because I don't have the answer.
Mm.
It's such a hard process of knowing what you, quote, deserve to be doing, right? And there's that stereotype out there, oh, millennials, they just think they should be running the world or whatever. And
I'm like, you guys are the ones that told us that.
Right, yeah, dream big. Yeah. As, you know, the executive whatever of nothing. It's a tough kind of contradiction to grapple with of feeling so empowered to go do something and change the world, but then have marginal responsibility. And I think what helps is having the patience in a job to at least work with your employer to understand what the path is like. And so as long as you're starting in, let's say, an entry-level position where you may not feel quite as jazzed about what you're doing as you thought you would be, working with your employer as well as your mentors to think about what tangible steps can you be taking along the way that will be indicators of you getting closer to that next promotion or that next responsibility. And if you're with an employer who just says, no, you're just in that role, you're going to stay there, that's probably another great
warning sign. Yeah.
So that's a tricky one. And then I'd also say that another tough thing about your 20s is every time you move, you basically have to restart that process, because especially in certain fields like politics, people expect you to go up the ranks, right? You don't just show up unless you have a show called The Apprentice and suddenly take the highest office, right? So having the humility to work your way up is a tough one and requires a lot of perseverance.
Sure. And so I'll let you get back to your trajectory. So you went from the governor's office to Northwest.
Nailed it. Yes. It's a tough one. If you saw it spelled, it would, a lot of people call it Eco Northwest.
Okay.
But anyways, that's neither here nor there. So then realized that economic consulting wasn't for me. Going back to those tests I was talking about, I didn't feel like I was moving toward that North Star. I kept asking questions of what else is it that I could be doing here that perhaps would get me closer to that fulfillment and building more development in areas I wanted to. And then actually there was this huge event that happened in 2016 when a certain guy got elected president, and that was a moment when my North Star shifted or became a little bit more apparent, and I said, okay, I have to drop everything. I need to get back in politics. And I think that's another crucial thing to point to in your 20s is this is the period of time when you are freer than you'll ever be. You presumably don't have a mortgage. You're probably not married. And the only kid you have is probably a dog, in my case, a little 7-pound guy named Ty. But anyways, use that freedom to test whatever you can and to test whatever theory you want to. So for me, that next theory was, maybe being a lobbyist could be a really fun opportunity. So I went to become the, quote, deputy legislative director. A little bit of title inflation there, to work for Children First for Oregon.
Okay. And so that was after how long at Echo Northwest?
It's about 4.5 months. So yeah.
That really wasn't a good one, was it?
You know, great people. I would not have a negative thing to say about the people I worked with. They were so smart.
The job just wasn't for you.
Yeah, they knew Stata like the back of their hand.
Oh, man.
Doing regressions all over the place, discontinuity, what have you. But for me, it was just, this is not scratching that itch.
Yeah. And so then to become a lobbyist. And I kind of want to ask a question about your point just then, which is your 20s is a time to experiment. I think I really like that idea, but I think there's also this kind of prevailing view that you can't experiment too much because then your CV is going to look really disjointed. I think that seems to be particularly a concern in America, where I think the work culture is just a little bit more intense and gaps in your CV are a little more abnormal than maybe in other parts of the world where people just take off traveling all the time. So how do you kind of navigate that question, wanting to experiment but also wondering whether you're leaving yourself exposed to judgment that you perhaps don't have a coherent narrative or you can't hold down a job or those kinds of things?
It's a tough one. Folks have called me opportunistic before, to which I say, what's the bad part about that? Aren't we supposed to seize opportunities that you're interested in and that present themselves? And now more than ever, shouldn't I be doing that? So,
do you think you would have a concern if you were an employer employing you?
So that's a valid point, and I definitely have always tried to keep in mind what sort of good faith agreement am I getting into with my employer, and keeping their interests in mind as well. And for me, something that's been slightly comforting is knowing we're in a very strong economy. So me being gone, I'm super replaceable,
right?
To be blunt, right? You can.
I'm sure
find,
you're not that replaceable, but
my bad
I take
jokes
your point.
Are
yeah.
tough to find. But you're gonna find so many smart folks who can fill my shoes pretty quickly. So I try to limit that idea that you have to stay at a job for a year or something like that, just because if you're showing up those last 4 months, for example, just not wanting to be there and not putting in 100%, you're not helping the employer and you're not helping yourself. So what is the point of this idea of, oh, you know, stick it out? Why? No one's winning in that situation.
It's sort of like the argument about sticking out books. I don't know if you're one of these people, but I sort of came to a turning point where I used to feel like I had to finish every book I started, and now I'm like, there are so many books in the world.
So
why
many.
Would I ever stick with one that was boring?
Yeah, no, same goes with movies, right? But yeah, so I think the important thing to do with each job is think about what skills are you picking up. And instead of trying to build a CV that's only focused on, well, I worked for a year and a half here and 3 years here, so this shows loyalty. Sadly, loyalty is kind of not a big commodity anymore in our economy, for better or for worse. And so if you can show that you're developing skills and adding value wherever you go, I think that's more important. So when I was at Echo, I still did good work. Hopefully the folks there agree, and took my project seriously. And while I was there, poured a lot of effort into them. And then as a lobbyist, I rode my bike from Portland to Salem, 65 miles, just to testify for one bill to help keep Oregon's bike lanes more protected and make them more ubiquitous. So if you pour yourself into even a short stint at a company, at least you're going to be able to walk into that next interview and say, look, I know it was short, but I still learned a lot. I helped out a lot. And these are the skills that I'm now going to be able to apply to this next role.
And so in that interview, do you try and build a coherent narrative out of the roles you've had, or do you really just focus on the skills that you've developed in each job and how that applies to the next one?
This kind of gets back to the idea of keeping some sort of a North Star. And for me, you should always be able to go back and pull a common thread throughout your jobs and tell that narrative so that you can help the employer, the interviewer, actually understand how the heck you think. And so for me, it's always been a process of trying to be in a position where I can learn a lot and help out on a problem that I care about. And as long as I can show how I've been working toward that, then I think I give that interviewer a sense of security that there is something driving me that makes sense, and it's not just a hodgepodge of me throwing a dart at a LinkedIn board.
Right, yeah. And I mean, it seems to have worked out pretty well for you so far. So, I mean, we'll see.
We'll see
what happens.
See,
it seems like UC Berkeley has let you defer for a few more years by the sounds of things.
They've been very kind to me, that law school. So I really do think, though, a good test is whenever you're in a place to open more doors and to learn more about yourself, go ahead and do it. So I always knew that law school was always in my back pocket, and Berkeley wasn't going anywhere, but the chance to work for Governor Brown, for example, would only exist for a finite period. I wasn't going to be a body guy when I'm 35.
Right.
Well, I don't know. If she's Madam President, I'd vote for it. But always putting things in the context of what's available to you now that perhaps won't be later. And secondly, trying to open as many doors as possible for yourself so that you are in a position to say no. And then once you find the right door to jump through, just go through it with reckless abandon.
That sounds like a pretty good way to approach things. So we're going to take a quick song break now, and then we'll be back. Kevin will have a bit of a public service announcement for us. And then we'll keep the conversation going. Perhaps we'll move on to your next role. So without further ado, let's see if I can get this off without any technical difficulties. And we're back. Kevin, do you want to bring us the public service announcement?
Sure. This is for my beautiful niece, Ava, out there in Portland, Oregon. Children are naturally curious. They want to learn, so follow their lead. If they like to help out in the kitchen, let them stir the spaghetti sauce or count the eggs. While doing laundry, fold in a lesson about colors and shapes. Simple learning games can be fun for both of you. Everyday moments are learning moments. It's easy. And when you talk with your child, you build vocabulary. Learning starts long before school does. For more tips, go to bornlearning.org. A public service announcement brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and WMFO.
Thanks for that, Kevin. What was it while doing your laundry? Lessons about colors and shapes?
You know, that's what I keep in mind.
I was going to say, I feel like anything to make that more bearable, I might take that advice for myself. So we might jump back to where we were. So you took the lobbying job. You rode your bicycle 65 miles once upon a time to testify for what was it again?
It was for safe routes to school, making sure kids could walk and bike to their school.
Wow, commitment. So how long did you stay in that role?
So that was about 5.5 or 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then where to?
So then I had the chance to go work for Google as a legal assistant on their legal investigation support team, which is a name that tells you nothing about what I actually did. Essentially, my team worked on responding to legal requests for user data.
Right. Okay. So is that when users want copies of their own data? Because that's something you can just download now, isn't it?
Wow, you're savvy. Yeah, yeah.
You know, Google, that Google takeout. Class, yeah.
You could have answered so many of my questions. Yeah, so quick pitch for Google's takeout policy. You can actually download everything Google has on you, and you should sign up to do your Google digital death, essentially, so that when you die or pass away, someone actually gets your data. Anyways, so legal requests for data, everyone from wives suing for their husbands' emails to find out if they cheated on them to the SEC looking into who started a fake cryptocurrency.
Wow. Okay. So that was the role that you had right up until coming to grad school, or?
Bingo.
Yeah. Okay. So that was 4 jobs in 4.5 years?
Oof. 4 jobs in...
Less, maybe.
Less, for sure. Maybe 3.5 years? Something around that.
Okay. So, kind of interested in the point you brought up, and this ties into that kind of time frame and the number of jobs you had, where you said loyalty isn't such a valuable commodity in the job market these days. And I know you didn't mean that kind of in any callous sense. It was just there are other things that are more important, maybe like the energy that you bring to the job. How do you see that playing out in the future? You mentioned your dad's been at or had been at AT&T for 30 years, and still a lot of CEOs that we see today have been at the same company or at least in the same industry for a long period of time. Do you think our generation will suffer from a loss of kind of institutional knowledge?
So I think if I had to put on my future of work hat,
yeah,
I would guess that what's going to happen is work's going to become more and more skill-based. And what's going to happen is firms are basically going to say, hey, we need X number of people with Y skills. And as soon as this project's over, I think we're good to go. And so here again, we're seeing an example where this emphasis on loyalty may not be continuing on, given that we're going to get firms are going to be more and more focused on what is the exact value you're going to add when you come into the office that day. And as soon as they feel like they have all of the maximum potential and all of the resources you can bring to the table, I think they'll probably look for the next skill they need and someone who has perhaps that in higher quantities, which is kind of sad to think about.
I was about to say, do you find that kind of like a sad and transactional way of going about life? I sort of feel like I'm always torn between whether I think in an ideal world work is sort of fused with the rest of life in a beautiful harmony, or whether work is strictly compartmentalized. But I think this model even just feels like unstable and like you're being used almost.
For sure. No, I think it's really cause for concern and cause for thinking about what is it that we're actually doing? What are we building? What are we spending 40, 60 hours of our work weeks contributing to if we're just viewed as a body bag of skills that they get to use for X amount of time, right? And we're seeing what this looks like at places like Amazon, where workers are getting more and more fed up about the fact that they have these crazy high quotas they have to hit on a daily basis. And, you know, you hear really, really sad stories about folks who are injuring themselves just to make sure that enough people can get that new toy for Christmas or whatever. And that's
terrifying.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the kind of economy anyone really wants, right? So I think we're getting to a point where we're going to have to talk more about, is the gig economy good if we're not making work something that's providing meaning in people's lives? And if work's not providing meaning, but you're spending 40 to 60 hours there each week, it's hard to have meaning in other parts of life. So it is a sad future that I do think we have to work to prevent.
But for now, you're sort of going to just lean into it? Or do you think it's just a more complex?
Well, so you asked about the future of work writ large.
Yeah.
So for me, I think it's finding the certain areas that haven't been hit by that pure skill commoditization yet, right? So,
and maybe politics is one of those.
Politics, I do think, is one of those where we haven't quite found the formula and
to squeeze it out of someone
right,
and throw them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one field. I think the nonprofit sector will hopefully always be a spot where people can be more focused on their holistic approach to work rather than just their productivity. And so I think for those positions where it is skill-based and something like, what is your productivity measurement? That's something that's on the rest of us who get to be in a position to feel like we're adding meaning to our work, to think everyone deserves that opportunity. Everyone deserves to come home and go to their kid or go to their dog, in my case, and say, hey, you know what? I did something really great today. I made the world a better place, and I feel good about that work. That's what I think is so fundamental to the whole dignity and work argument that we've heard for so long, right? For that to be true, work has to be dignified. And so that's something I think we're going to have to figure out.
Do you think that dignity is something you can find in many jobs, large or small? Or do you think, like from a personal perspective, do you think that's something you can find in a lot of different jobs? Or do you have sort of a burning passion and idea of what that dream job is and you're just trying to work your way to get there?
I think it's important, going back to maybe the first point, that there is no perfect job. And so if you hold out for this idea that you're only going to feel dignified when you've found your ideal job, well, then you're probably not going to be happy. You're probably not going to be doing great work, even though you may be solving someone's problem. So quick shout out to the wonderful baristas at Flower Bakery because they make my day so much better almost every single day, right? As many days as I get a hot chocolate, but I don't want to admit how many days.
Those hot chocolates are really good. I like the fiery one,
spicy
one.
Tried it.
Yeah,
oh, shoot.
Recommend.
Okay. But, you know, there are folks who will say, oh, you're, quote, just a barista or just a mailman or what mail person, whatever that position may be. And dignity and that sense of contribution can come from any chance, in my opinion, you have to forge a community. So you may not initially think of someone like a barista as adding to a community, but in the case of the wonderful folks at Flower, I got coffee at a different shop with one of the baristas to talk about law school. and I ask about their day, and we ask about each other's days, and now it's a relationship, right? So we've added something more to just the exchange of a hot chocolate. It's the exchange of conversation and how someone's doing. And so that adds a little bit of an obligation to all of us to look beyond just what role someone formally has to say, how are we all making life a little bit easier for one another?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And on the importance of relationships in terms of kind of keeping society ticking, is that something you optimize for when you're choosing jobs? Like, if you're having to choose between the people in a workplace, whether that's, you know, whether they're nice people to work with or whether it's the networks they bring or the subject matter itself, what do you go for? Or does it depend?
Well, the future lawyer in me would say everything is a it depends answer. But I would say really err on the side of the people, where if you think of the worst assignment you've ever had in school, if you're surrounded by your best friends and you get assigned that, it's no big deal, right? You're going to have a blast. You'll go hang out. You'll get some work product produced at some point. Who knows? But you'll have a good time because you're with people you really enjoy spending time with. And earlier in the break, we were talking about the idea of going on a first date, having 30 minutes of casual small talk, and then deciding, oh, all right, well, here comes a year of spending time together. So much in the same way, this idea that, oh, you'll go on one interview, have a lousy coffee, and then say, oh, I'm going to work at this place for a year. Well, if you have that mindset, it's even more important to think, these better be some really good people I'm about to spend a year with, because in many cases, you're going to spend more time with those people than your, quote, loved ones. So you better find a way to love the people you're with at work. And if that doesn't seem possible, I would really think about finding a better community where you work.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think we grow up, go through school, go through higher education institutions, and there's so much emphasis on grades and achieving in an academic sense, and in many ways that's the ticket that gets you into the workplace. But I think what I was really surprised at once I started working was that at a sort of threshold intellect, everything else is just, are you a fun person to have in the office? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, answering yes to that question is going to outweigh whether or not you're on the 85th or 95th percentile in terms of intellect. And I think that's just a really important part of work that isn't really emphasized as much in your formal education.
No, it's a great point that I would much rather have the fun person in the room than the person who makes everyone feel dumb because they're so smart and they just rub it in your face, right?
Yeah, and I think there are probably some jobs which, I mean, I think Malcolm Gladwell calls it, what's the phrase he uses? I'm going to have to look this up after, but there are jobs where having, or workplaces where having kind of one star performer is really important. And I think maybe he uses programming as an example of that. Like, your star programmer is miles better than just your average programmer. But for most workplaces, it's kind of just much more important how a team works together and that everyone's a pretty good performer, but they work well together, and it's less important to kind of really try and have those stars. So yeah, I think from my perspective, choosing teams and workplaces based on the people can be like a good approach.
Yeah, and that's something I'm really excited about, is how are we going to get better at identifying who's a good addition to your team earlier? Because we have all these new behavioral science-informed interview questions, right? At Google, I got asked to teach my interviewer something. So I got down and I showed her a crow position. in yoga.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did that go?
I almost ripped my pants, but I didn't. So that would have been...
Yeah, that is bold. Were you in a suit? I don't know what people at Google wear.
Google has a rule that you don't have to wear a suit to be serious. So yes, a perk of the Silicon mindset. But yeah, so I think as we get better at identifying what are the attributes that make up a great team and how can you identify that earlier, hopefully you'll be able to go on that first date and know you're going to be in a comfortable relationship for a long time.
Yeah, or at least be more accepting that it's okay to bail out earlier than a year if that's not the case.
There you go. That's a good alternative. You don't have to make it to Valentine's Day.
So what made you finally come to grad school?
So coming to grad school was a tough one, but really I feel like I finally had a better sense of what that North Star was. And so now that I've finally come to this realization that I want to make government more efficient, more equitable by applying new tech, I thought, oh, wow, this is something I could actually concretely study instead of, oh, I just want to be a lawyer, and having a public policy degree sounds nice.
Right.
So now it's been so comforting to be able to look at a syllabus and look at a bunch of courses and think, does this get me closer to that North Star? And if it doesn't, I just don't do it. And it's been really freeing to be at grad school with that perspective instead of approaching each term with trepidation because I'm still trying to assess out, is this at all related to what I want to do in my life? And that's why I ultimately felt comfortable making the jump to HKS and next year back over to Berkeley.
Cool. Well, Kevin, we're all glad that you did make the jump back. I'm sure there are a few more jobs that you could have hopped to before coming over. And we'll definitely miss you when you go to Berkeley, but looking forward to seeing what the next few jobs are going to hold for you. And yeah, we might leave it there, but thanks so much for coming in and sharing your insights. I think for everyone trying to navigate the job market at this kind of interesting time to be in it, it's just great to hear from people who are doing it kind of differently.
Well, thanks for having me and great talking with you. Thanks for hosting the show.
All right. Everyone else, you've been listening to WMFO Medford, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
screaming little boy and girl, we drew that first breath. We had some sense of what we'd left. It had me crying in my mother's arms. For you, my highest love, my highest love, my highest love, will we recall? My highest love, my highest love, my highest love. We learn to pay the rent. Yes, I learned to forget your face. The scent of your skin lingering like a shadow on a memory. And no strangers we meet. Is it you? My highest love, my highest love, my highest love. Will we?
Hey guys, it's Brian Young of A Crash Course for the Ravers.
It's a crash course for the ravers.
Where we play deep cuts, lost classics, live tracks, your requests, and plenty of local rock sprinkled throughout. I'm joined by my beautiful co-host, Marie Michelle.
That's me.
1 to 4 p.m. Saturdays. Don't miss it on 91.5 WMFO in Medford.
Anything and everyone you know. We trash in and they take a man.
is Riley James, and you're listening to 91.5 WMFO.